Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your inabilities, or your abilities. Later in the service, we'll invite our visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services, and they're either presented by a Prairie member, as is true today, a member of the wider community, or our minister, Sandra Ingham. Today, Ken Haydock will be presenting a service on Quakers. Please welcome Pam and Gary Gates to light our chalice.
We light this chalice to find inner peace, love for each other, and faith in ourselves. Also to be welcoming to whomever we meet and kind to all living creatures. So gather around this light of hope as we share this time together. This is from the Oberlin UU Fellowship Middle School Faith Development Class.
Next part to come on. And that will be the presentation by Ken Haydock. I was not given a description of Ken to read to you, but I know that Ken has been coming to Prairie for several years now. I know he's an attorney. I know he's spoken to us several times, and everyone always likes to hear him speak because he's well organized. He always knows, he always has a lot to say. And I think this is true, that he taught something about Quakers down in the, was it the high school class? And he wanted to share what he learned with us. And so I think we have a lot to look forward to. So Ken Haydock, and I'll light those candles.
Okay. Is the microphone working? Okay. I carefully chose as the title of this Quakers. It is not everything you could possibly know about Quakers. It's not possible in the time allotted to do justice to the over 350-year history of the Religious Society of Friends, open parenthesis, Quakers, close parenthesis. I'm actually giving a couple of talks here today. Right now I want to talk briefly about some parallels between Unitarian Universalists and most Quakers in North America today. And then I'm going to launch into a brief run through the first 300 years of Quaker history, but as reflected in the lives of some specific Quakers, some of them famous, some of them really obscure. But what I'd like you to consider when we get into that is what concerned these people and what experience were they having? And I think that will reflect a lot more Quaker history than I'm going to specifically name. After this service and a potluck lunch in this room, there will be a meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. And there I'm going to talk about something which I discovered in the course of preparing for this talk, which is how in recent history the Religious Society of Friends came to function as five distinct and different denominations, all called the Religious Society of Friends. And I use the word denominations. Other, you know, formal critics have used that term, and I tend to agree. That's an interesting history as well. But all Unitarian Universalists and all Quakers do not impose a creed as a condition of membership. Most Unitarians and Universalists in North America today, I think you can fairly say, are very similar in terms of demographics, education, politics, socioeconomic status, that sort of thing. The Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations has set out 7 principles that inform Unitarian Universalist belief and practice. They are posted around this room. As a personal aside, I like to think of them when they are posted this way as the stations of the chalice. That's just me. Most Quakers in North America embrace a short list of examples of Quaker witness or Quaker values. And they are simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality, and stewardship. And there's very little there, nothing there that I can think of that conflicts with the 7 principles. 7 principles, 6 values. The value of integrity, which I should honor here, forces me to indicate that part of the reason there will be only one hymn today is I wanted to buy more time.
It is
simplicity. See, they all tie together. Now, also, among the groups within the Religious Society of Friends in North America, again, there are a couple that are known as liberal Quakers, capital L, capital Q. And these are mainly folks who are members of monthly meetings west of the Rockies that are independent, and monthly meetings that are found across America affiliated with the Friends General Conference, just so you know. Details after lunch. These groups have, in recent decades, begun to accept as full members, much as Unitarian Universalists have in recent years, folks who are not traditional Protestant theists. And just as it is possible, as the Unitarian Universalist here will know, to be a Jewish Unitarian Universalist or a Buddhist Unitarian Universalist or a humanist Unitarian Universalist, it is now accepted that someone can be a Buddhist Quaker or a non-theist Quaker. Didn't know that when I started doing some research on this. This would be another similarity. There are a number of these parallels, but I think that I've always found it curious that the main interaction between the Religious Society of Friends and the Unitarian Universalist tends to be a sharing of religious education materials. That's been going on for generations. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about some aspects of the Quakers unique to them, and talk about some Quaker history. I'd like to start in the year 1650. Relax, we're not going to cover every year. By 1650, several of the people who I'm going to mention have already been born. In 1611, Mary Barrett. In 1624, George Fox. In 1640, a fellow with whom I happen to share a uniquely Lancashire surname, a fellow named John Haydock, was born. 3 years later, the first of his younger brothers, Roger, is born. And in the next year, 1644, to an admiral of the Royal Navy, who was very rich, he had financial dealings with the king, and to the admiral's wife, was born William Penn. Now, by the year 1650, George Fox had pretty much formulated his understanding of the relationship between man and God. And I would argue that there are 2 principles from which all the other aspects of Quaker belief and practice emanate. The first is that every person has within him or her that of the divine, something that he referred to as the inward light, today more commonly the inner light. And the second was that God can speak directly to the hearts of men and women if they would but sit quietly and wait upon the still, small voice. Everything else radiates from that. If we are all in possession of an inward light, we are all equal. If God can speak to us directly, what need is there for intermediaries, the clergy, or ritual, or any sacrament other than the sacrament of life itself? And if God can speak to us directly and in the present day, then the Bible, although revelation, is not the most immediate or the most recent revelation. And you can see what that does to the importance of the Bible. Now, to us today, none of this seems all that radical or threatening. But we're in 1650 England. The country has been for decades subjected to open warfare. There are two armies roaming around the country up until this time, one representing the royalists, the other representing the parliament. And there will be open combat from time to time. Part of the concern is how the country will be governed, but also part of it is religious. If you're living in this era, if you do not accept the authenticity of the head of state and his policies, well, that's treason, especially in time of war, and this effectively is time of war. And if you do not embrace the beliefs and practices of the established church, why, that's heresy. And both treason and heresy were seen equally, not just as bothersome, but as threats to the existence of England. To the point that last year, 1649, they decapitated the king. Cromwell is now on the stage of history. In the year 1650, George Fox, for the first time, is thrown in prison for expressing his beliefs. One of the problems with these dates is when you go to different sources, some are still using the Julian calendar, some are on the Gregorian calendar. Just bear with me. Little latitude. It is also the year that in a court in Derby, the judge in open court applies a term that was in general use to refer to all the little dissident groups. I mean, being a Catholic was no piece of cake in this era. Within recent memory, people were put to death if they were priests and found to be celebrating Mass. There was a certain amount of safety in numbers for the Presbyterians, but there were all of these little groups. There were the Adamites and the Ranters and the Fifth Monarchy men, and yes, the followers of George Fox. And the judge, in open court, derisively labels Fox and his followers with this term, Quakers. And it stuck more to the Children of the Light, or Friends of the Light, as they came to call themselves, than any other group, and it took centuries to become basically just a familiar nickname. It was also the year that Mary Barrett, who is now married, and she is now Mary Dyer, is in England. Now, she had emigrated back in 1637 to England with her husband, to New England, rather, with her husband. But for whatever reason, she is back in England at this point, and she hears George Fox preach. And she becomes a convert, or in Quaker terminology, convinced. And her convincement does not lead her just to become a practicing Quaker. It leads her, in the terminology of the day, to become a Quaker minister. Now, this isn't somebody who delivers a sermon and leads a worship service that was not part of Quaker practice, I'm sure you're aware. Rather, it's someone who proselytizes, speaks out on behalf of the faith. Now, we'll catch up with her in a decade, but right now, let's move ahead 2 years, and it's the year 1652. And George Fox is in Lancashire, near the town of Clitheroe, where there is a geographical feature called Pendle Hill. And he has moved to ascend to the top of Pendle Hill. And that day he has a vision of an ocean of men and women all dressed in white. And he takes this to be a sign that one day there will be thousands and thousands of people who accept his, George Fox's, understanding of God's will. So when he descends from Pendle Hill, he does not desist in preaching, he persists in preaching. When you think of Pendle Hill, do not think of Bascom Hill. Pendle Hill is 1,827 feet high, and if it were in North America, we'd call it a mountain. It's now 1660, and we're in Boston, and here is Mary Dyer. What's happened to Mary Dyer since we left her a decade ago? Well, she had returned to New England, Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, with her husband, who is not and never becomes a Quaker, and she expresses her religious views. The powers that be did not like this. Who were the powers that be? Why, the Puritans. The original Mayflower descendants and their friends, what were they up to? Well, they were known to shoot Native Americans or sell them into slavery, to burn books they didn't approve of, to label people they didn't like, warlocks and witches, and set fire to them. And they had a particular distaste for Quakers. The Puritans considered themselves to be the correct Church of England, and these people were heretics. If you were a ship's captain in this era and you brought a Quaker or even Quaker literature into port, you would be fined very heavily pretty much anywhere in New England. So when they find Mary out and about speaking out on behalf of her beliefs, they apply to her the lesser of the two penalties associated with heresy: banishment. And where did the Puritans in that era send the apostates and the heretics they found in their midst? Why? No, not yet. They sent them to that filthy quagmire and poison splash of all theological abominations, Rhode Island. They shipped her to Rhode Island. So she and her family, they have children at this point, moved to Rhode Island. Mary is given to be nice and supportive of her friends and neighbors. And at one point, a friend of hers has serious business to attend to in Boston, and Mary accompanies her. It's a small world, and Mary is spotted on the streets of Boston and taken into custody. And she is escorted to the edge of town along with two Quaker men who had been out and about proselytizing. And they were led to a tree, and a rope was thrown over a branch of the tree, and a noose was placed around the neck of the first man, and he was hanged for being a Quaker. And the noose was placed around the neck of the second man, and he was hanged for being a Quaker. And the noose was placed around Mary Dyer's neck and then removed. The powers to be allowed is how folks had interceded on her behalf, and they were prepared to have her simply returned to exile in Rhode Island. It wasn't good public relations to hang Quaker women unnecessarily. In 1660, Mary Dyer returns to Boston, and she is again found on the streets, and this time the authorities are prepared to carry out the heavier of the two penalties. In the beauty of their souls, they offer her an opportunity to repent. "Nay, I came to keep blood guiltiness from you, desiring you to repeal the unrighteous and unjust law made against the innocent servants of the Lord. Nay, man, I am not now to repent. Only slightly abridged, those are Mary Dyer's words. Those are Mary Dyer's last words. And she was hanged for being a Quaker. In 1661, the following year, the Quakers from around New England sent delegates together, and they formed a group called the New England Yearly Meeting. It exists and functions to this day. It is also the year that Charles II, Oliver Cromwell, has now left the stage of history. The Restoration has occurred in the form of Charles II coming to the throne. He wasn't all that big on discrimination, being actually a Catholic. And he sends a note to the Plymouth, or the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you are not to hang or put to death any Quakers. You can bring charges, send them to England. We'll deal with them here. In 1666, we find William Penn, who has recently been kicked out of Christ Church, Oxford. He didn't fit in. He's traveling on family business in Ireland, and he falls in with some Quakers. And on his return to England, he makes it publicly known that he has become a convinced Quaker. In the year 1667, John Haydock up in Lancashire falls in with Quakers, and he becomes convinced. Now, his parents were Anglicans, although his mother was known to harbor strong Presbyterian sentiments. Was she, as a nonconformist Protestant, did she take a better view of having a Quaker son? She did not. She turned to her second oldest son, Roger, and asked him to talk some sense into his older brother. And at this task, Roger fails miserably. And now there are not just two Quakers in the family, but two Quaker ministers. John will go on to proselytize throughout England and Scotland. And at one point, he takes a trip that George Fox himself had taken about a decade earlier. And he travels from England to Barbados, and then up the eastern seaboard of North America, proselytizing and meeting with Quakers who have already settled there. To get from England to Barbados in that day involved being in a small wooden sailing vessel on the high seas for 7 weeks. This was not a trip that people took lightly. In fact, traveling just around Europe in the late 1600s took a toll on people medically and physically. Bear that in mind as well. Roger, just in the years 1680 and 1681, is out and traveling around Ireland, Holland, Germany, Scotland. Is this unusual? No, there are hundreds of Quakers out raising interest in their religion. 1681 is an important year in Quaker history, though. Not only is it the year that the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting was founded, it is the year that Charles II, to settle a debt he owed to Admiral Penn, grants to William Penn a vast tract of land in the New World, which, to William's embarrassment and the king's great amusement, the king personally names Penn Sylvania. Now, you know that William Penn travels to Pennsylvania. He helps to found Philadelphia. He personally conducts the first of a series of treaty negotiations with the Native Americans. The first was with the Lenni Lenape people. You probably think that he stays there and runs the colony, and you'd be wrong. He leaves after 3 years. He spends the rest of his life, except for one other trip of about 3 years, in England. He's an Englishman. In the year 1696, we find William Penn in England, and he is at meeting for worship in Bristol, seaport in the southwestern quadrant of England. And he's standing there, and standing opposite him is a woman named Hannah Callowhill. Now, why are they standing facing each other in the middle of a meeting for worship? They're marrying one another. In the absence of clergy, Quakers would marry one another, and may to this day. Who's Hannah Callowhill? Well, she is a convinced Quaker. She is from a very wealthy family. And it's not easy to have marriages approved. It has to be approved by the meeting before it occurs. And after the meeting, there's a table, they set out a piece of parchment, and people sign a document indicating that they were witnesses to this marriage. This is the legal proof of it. It was a big deal. 66 people signed the document. And one of them was a friend of William Penn's, Roger Haydock. Well, you think that would make that year a banner year for Roger. And you'd be wrong, because in May he dies. This very greatly upsets his older brother, who gathers together some of Roger's writings, theological tracts, thick pamphlets, and adds to it a little biography of his brother, and has this published in the year 1700, and that's how we know what we know about Roger. In the year 1718, we find William Penn in England, in bed, horizontal. Why? He's on his deathbed. Over the preceding 8 years, he had a series of increasingly debilitating strokes. And during this 8 year period, Hannah Callowhill Penn increasingly looks after the family business and the affairs of the Pennsylvania colony. Now, Penn and his first wife, who had died some time ago, had 4 children who survived infancy. And William and Hannah had 8 children who survived infancy, mainly boys. And when William dies, it's not one of his sons who takes over as looking after the affairs of Pennsylvania. It's Hannah Callowhill Penn. And she persists in this role of being effectively the governor of the Pennsylvania colony for the next 11 years until she dies, ironically also, of a stroke. Strong woman. On the day William married Hannah, he was 52. She was 25. The following year, after William Penn's death, his 1719, and we find John Haydock in Lancaster Castle. No, it's not a royal palace. It's the largest prison in Lancashire. Is it unusual for a Quaker to be in this prison? No, hundreds have been put in this prison for various reasons. George Fox himself spent years there on 2 occasions. Why is John in prison? He has refused to pay the tithe. What's the tithe? Well, it's a tax, the proceeds of which go to support the clergy of the established Anglican Church. Quakers didn't like this. They also didn't like it because, and this is so 21st century, the monies that were collected in poor areas tended to wind up being spent in the richer areas of the country, and they were opposed to it on moral grounds as a general matter as well. What is significant then about John being in Lancaster Castle protesting the tithe? Turns out he was the last man in England to die in prison protesting the tithe. Now, why were these people dying in prison? It would be 100 years, exactly a century later, that Elizabeth Fry, a Quaker woman, was visiting Lancaster Castle to observe the construction of a woman's prison there. Lancaster Castle served as a prison from around 1200 until 5 years ago, incidentally. It's now a museum. And there are reflected in George Fox's writings descriptions of his being imprisoned in a cell with a barred window open to the elements. Imagine that in winter. Food, awful. Sanitary facilities, non-existent. When Elizabeth Fry, a century later, calls together friends of hers, and many Quakers rally to her cause, she doesn't manage to improve prison conditions in England. She manages to improve prison conditions throughout the entire English-speaking world. In the year 1743, one of Roger's sons emigrates to Philadelphia. In the year 1748, a fellow is born named Elias Hicks. And I have some pictures of Hicks. This is him when he's in his 70s. And if you just pass him around so everybody gets a look at, and they're not all exactly the same. We're going to be coming to him in due course, but just want to make sure everybody gets a chance to take a look at the gentleman. I got more here than I thought. Just share these around. Okay. We'll get back to him in a minute. Well, we're going to rest for a while in the year 1796 and 1797. There's another fellow named John Haydock, and he is a descendant of Rogers through the fellow who emigrated. And he is a Quaker, and he is now at the Rahway, New Jersey monthly meeting. And someone comes to the Rahway, New Jersey monthly meeting, a woman named Cynthia Myers, and she leaves a petition there. And now a monthly meeting is called a monthly meeting because it's a meeting for business that occurs once a month, even though the same people will gather weekly or more frequently in a meeting for worship. So the monthly meeting, business part, decides that they're going to refer this petition to a committee. And John happens to head the committee of 12 men who consider it, and they decide, you know, this is sufficiently significant. We probably should take this to the quarterly meeting, which is representatives of monthly meetings in the immediate area. And that group decides, let's take this to the Philadelphia yearly meeting. And in short order, the Philadelphia yearly meeting basically comes back to Rahway, New Jersey, and says, you tell us that Cynthia Myers has petitioned you for membership, and that she tells you that she has accepted Quaker beliefs. And you tell us that you believe she is sincere in her convincement. Well, accept her as a member. And they do. In the late 1700s, Cynthia Myers becomes a Quaker, even though she is a mulatto. And the color line starts to fall among the Quakers in North America. It will be 150 years before it falls in American baseball. This gets us to the year 1827. Here's what the historians tell us was going on, mainly in England. The persecution of the Quakers and other nonconformist groups had died away. Laws that had been on the books went unenforced or removed. And Quakers increasingly were involved in business activities. And they became highly valued members of the business community. They were known for scrupulous honesty, fair dealing, reliability. They became prosperous. And they began to think, we'd really like to be better received among our socioeconomic peers. I don't think they use that term, but we should be received as equals by Presbyterians and Anglicans and Congregationalists and Methodists. Why don't we introduce into our worship elements they have in theirs? Why don't we introduce readings from the Bible? Why don't we have formally trained ministers in the modern sense? And why don't we sing some hymns? To the Quakers throughout England and to the wealthier Quakers in America in cities, this seemed to be a jolly good idea. To the rural Quakers, and Elias Hicks was born to a farming family in Jericho, Long Island, Nassau County, east of New York City. This was horrendous. This was horrifying. To introduce these changes would be to abandon the very precepts that underlay the religion of George Fox. No one was more articulate and outspoken on this subject than Elias Hicks, the fellow whose picture you've seen. He travels throughout New England, the Middle Atlantic states, and as far west as there are Quakers, Indiana. Yeah. And he is well loved. He apparently is a great orator. And what happens in 1827 is as follows in North America, because the Quakers who were of more modest means, not just the farmers, in urban areas, shopkeepers, artisans, laborers, they didn't cotton to these changes. So starting in 1827, in monthly meeting after monthly meeting, starting in the Philadelphia area, either the people who wanted these changes, who had called themselves Orthodox, or the people who opposed these changes, who became known as Hicksites, left their monthly meeting, founded a new one, and eventually built their own meeting house. And this split between the Orthodox and the Hicksites persists to this day. And it was the first of several to occur between that time and the early 1900s. For that, Humanist Union this afternoon to get into details. Now, just because you were a Hicksite didn't mean that you embraced everything that Elias Hicks cared about. Elias Hicks was morally opposed to the building of the Erie Canal. If God felt that man needed an intercontinental waterway, he would have provided a river. Okay? But it's also true that on Elias Hicks' deathbed, he repeatedly expressed his single greatest concern, which was that when he died, his shroud not be made of cotton, because cotton was a product of slavery. 1830. Now I'm going to jump ahead a fair amount. I should note one thing before we get to the year 1947. By about 1691, which is the time that George Fox died, one out of every 100 residents of England was a Quaker. High watermark. In 1947, the Norwegian Nobel Peace Prize Committee announced its award of the Peace Prize for that year. And the following year, it was accepted by the American representatives of the American Friends Service Committee and its British counterpart for the work that Quakers had done in World War I and recently ended World War II, handling the needs of refugees on both sides of the battle lines. But if you go back and look at the statement that was issued by the Norwegian Committee in 1947, you will find that the Peace Prize that year was awarded to the Religious Society of Friends, open parenthesis, Quakers, close parenthesis. And the folks who were the pariahs of England in the middle of the 1600s had won the respect and admiration of the civilized world. Now I'm going to close with a piece of a poem. It's a very lengthy poem. It's written by John Greenleaf Whittier, who was an American Quaker abolitionist poet. By consensus, we have, if any Quakers here were willing to stand down, we have agreed. He was born in Indiana. Yeah. I associate him with New England. But in any event, he wrote this poem in 1862, imploring the English to support the cause of abolitionism in North America. And I've long felt that these words work equally well to illustrate what Winston Churchill called the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom, but I think that they also work well in describing the relationship in contemporary North America between the Unitarian Universalists and the vast majority of Quakers. Whittier wrote, "Joint heirs and kinsfolk, leagues of waves nor length of years can part us. Your right is ours to shrine and grave the common freehold of the brave, the gift of saints and martyrs." Thank you. Well, my scope here was confined to North America purposefully. If you look at the Anglican Communion, the Anglican Communion, a majority of Anglicans today live in Africa, and similarly, about half of all self-described Quakers in the world are residents of Kenya, and in both cases, owing to missionary work that has been done. In England, when America was experiencing the Hicksite separation, the English Quakers were almost entirely what we would call Orthodox, and gradually over a century, they have become in line with the folks in North America who today call liberal Quakers in terms of their practices and acceptance of others. On that note, I'll share the fact that Unitarian Universalists are constantly in trying to explain their religious affiliation to folks unfamiliar with it. Well, Unitarian Universalists don't have a creed like the Quakers. The Quakers do exactly the opposite. We don't have a creed like the Unitarian Universalists. I've learned that. And I will share the two perfectly wonderful jokes. The Unitarian Universalists like to refer to the Quakers as Unitarian Universalists who can't sing, and the Quakers like to refer to Unitarian Universalists as Quakers with attention deficit disorder. I think that's probably better illustrated in the case of the United Kingdom than in the United States. In England, there was unity of practice was maintained. Of course, it's a smaller country as well. Rather than the coming together that produced Unitarian Universalism, the Quakers, and this is not to say that these various groups have animosity towards one another. The Orthodox and the liberals in particular are perfectly have perfectly good relations, as I understand it. I should note, if you think you'll be singing a Quaker hymn, no, you'll be singing a Shaker hymn. The Shakers split from the Quakers and were very different. And they danced in circles, but I don't think that's what we'll be doing.
All right, thanks all for coming, and please extend the hand of friendship to your neighbors, and join us for coffee and conversation.